Today on the Syneos Health Podcast, we return to real-world evidence. We'll be talking about interventional studies, what intervention actually means, and then how real-world evidence is collected differently from clinical trials that are interventional. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. I'll be joined by Tara Isherwood and Stuart McCulley from the Syneos Health Consulting Group. If you like what you're hearing, be sure to subscribe and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Real World Evidence, for the third time, on the Syneos Health Podcast. Tara and Stuart, you're both with Syneos Health Consulting, but your background has not been consulting long-term. Your background is clinical, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Worked in clinical trials and clinical research for a long time.
Stuart, you too?
Yeah, indeed. Most of my background, like Tara's, is clinical research with an emphasis on regulations for not clinical trials.
When you say regulations for not clinical trials, you mean just regulations for laboratory work and the like, or for QA, QC? I guess I'm not sure quite what you mean by not clinical trials.
Very good question. It very much is a case of human research or research that is in human beings that is not classified as a clinical trial. Things like non-interventional studies, observational studies, all of these kind of studies that we're seeing a lot more of now.
Very good. And today we're talking about how a clinical trial is different from a real-world evidence trial. And I have to admit, I guess I know that they have to be different in some sense. One's in the real world, one's in the clinic, and so one is designed differently. But beyond that, my understanding from the FDA regs is that we're trying to make them as close as possible to each other, that we treat real-world evidence as just another evidence source, and so we should have that same sort of rigor around them. Am I understanding correctly, or have I misunderstood, and these things are just different beasts for another reason?
We tend to say that clinical trials are slightly different to real-world research because in a clinical trial, you're dictating treatment via the protocol. And usually you're investigating an unapproved medicinal product of that disease area. What we're trying to do with real-world studies that we're running is to actually observe patients in real clinical practice. And so we're actually more of a light touch on the patients and seeing what the treatment patterns are for those patients. And so the regulatory framework that we follow for those studies is very different from clinical trials.
And are you limiting your answer to the EU? To the FDA, or is this true across geographies or even outside of both of those geographies?
There is some similarities with the US regulations and European regulations with how they consider a clinical investigation, they would call it in the US, and a clinical trial in Europe. If you're conducting something that is not used to alter the marketing or advertisement of your medicinal product, or if you're trying to get more data on something that's not approved, then actually they fall under the similar kind of frameworks. They're not exactly the same, but they're fairly similar.
If you go back to your point about rigor and FDA, the difference really when you're looking at a clinical trial versus, shall we say, a real-world study, isn't just about rigor, it's about risk. So the patients are already, in most cases, taking the treatment, taking the drug. What we're doing is gathering further information at the same time that they just continue to take the drug. So to Tara's point, we're not dictating an intervention, as it were, in their treatment.
When we talk about real-world evidence, we might talk about them as a non-intervention study versus an intervention study. What's an intervention? If you don't know what that means, what does it mean?
It's two elements. One, we kind of talked about intervention and non-intervention. It's like the white elephant, because intervention as a word is the thing that causes so much grief and confusion or lack of confidence, to your point, Jeff. Because without it being defined, how then do you know what the difference is between intervention and non-intervention? In the regulations, we haven't defined intervention. We have defined low intervention. And we talk about non-intervention, but we don't really define what it is. I've spent a lot of time with clients trying to help them understand the difference between a physical intervention and a treatment intervention. One does not make the other a clinical trial. There's a lot of consultation papers that have come out about real-world evidence, real-world data, how we generate it, and what level of quality is expected for it to be of regulatory submission acceptability, shall we say. That's kind of come on after the 21st Century Cures Act, which was a very innovative piece of regulation that helped us catch up with what we're actually doing in the real world versus what the drug law was actually capturing. It was so behind the times. Now we've got consultation papers from China, from the EMA, quite a few from the FDA. We've got them from the health technology assessors. And one of the flaws in all of this is they still use the term intervention, but they don't define what they mean. So rather than giving us more confidence that we can understand how to move forward, at the minute, it's just adding to the confusion. And all we need is a glossary, like we had in ICH-GCP, which said this is what we mean by clinical trial.
And the ICH-GCP is what?
The International Conference of Harmonization, so where these government bodies have come together to harmonize the understanding for good clinical practice, which is relevant to clinical trials. This is the guidance on how to run a clinical trial.
What kind of issues does that raise? So if we're not dictating an intervention, one thing that comes to my mind is that the placebo effect gets stronger depending on the color of the pill. If the pill is not a pill and it's an injectable as opposed to a pill, those are things that we might control in a clinical trial, in a prospective clinical trial, but we don't control them in a real-world study because what's on the control arm, so to speak, is whatever they're taking or might be.
The difference is in real-world research, sometimes we do actually use comparator arms. So we're comparing what patients would traditionally get with the new product that's being licensed. Sometimes that can happen, but that would still fall under the regulatory framework of a clinical trial because you're dictating treatment that the patient is receiving. If we're looking at risk of patients in routine care, it's not the same level of risk that these patients will be exposed to because the clinical trials and the evidence generation for the marketing authorization of the product has already occurred.
Things to consider really is a case of when you're talking about placebo effect and controls, that's not what we're looking at generally with real world research. In a clinical trial, you are comparing a new product with the gold standard. So you're wanting to understand if it, that drug, say, is as good as or better than what the existing drug is. Whereas in the real world research scenario, for example, we wouldn't have the inclusion-exclusion criteria that you would have for a clinical trial because we don't want to remove the variables just so we can work out whether the drug works and the benefits are such that they overwhelm the risks and it's beneficial to the patient. In the real-world scenario, we don't remove those variables. So the patients can have multiple conditions and be on multiple drugs, and then we can see how the drug is really used and then how effective it is in that situation.
Maybe one point to add to that actually is when we're observing patients in those types of scenarios, we often get asked the question about whether taking some blood samples or performing additional questionnaires that the patient would normally have as part of their care, would that then make the study a clinical trial because we're adding an intervention? And actually, it's not about physical intervention that makes a study a clinical trial. It's going back to this concept of treatment intervention. And that's where understanding the regulations for these different study types is really important. So if you're taking a blood sample from a patient, what the legislation is you're following can be different depending on the country that you're working in. And that's the area of expertise that we're particularly interested in. And just providing the right framework and guidance to people who are working on these studies in different countries. So that's definitely a myth that we try to change in people's minds is that having a blood sample or having a physical intervention doesn't equal a clinical trial.
You mentioned different regulations and different geographies and different regulatory bodies having different expectations or rules, and some of them can be a little obscure. Other than hire a good consultant, are there recommendations that you have for somebody who's familiar with clinical trials but not familiar with these different particular regulations that might at least provide some guidance as to thinking about it? I'm just making stuff up because I don't know the answer, but do you think of in Europe, you can never take a sample, and in the US, you always take a sample, or you need duplicates in these countries, X, Y, and Z? Are there big rules that even without an expert, people, if they knew them, would think differently?
That's a really great question. Almost certainly the regulations that surround clinical trials are well understood. People who work in clinical trials, they get really good training on them. and the understanding of what legislation applies in their own country and even to the regional level are really clear. When it gets to studies that are not clinical trials, actually it can be quite complex because they're not regionally harmonised. And what we would classify in one country is a non-interventional study versus an observational study can be different. There are other different legislation. So actually understanding your own country's legislation is really important and looking at what you're trying to achieve from your study. So there are differences. If you have a study that's observing care where there's no medicinal product, you're not observing any drugs that the patient is taking, you're just looking at treatment practices to understand a bit more about how this disease is treated in real life scenarios. So that type of study where there's no drug and your objectives of your study are not looking at the performance of the drug are different legislation that you would need to follow perhaps for something where you're observing a newly marketed product that's been prescribed as standard of care and you're looking at its continued safety and effectiveness in the treated population. So understanding what you're trying to achieve from your study will then lead you to the regulations or legislation that then apply in those countries.
Here in the United States, I know that most states, like 49, I think, of the 50 states, follow English common law as an example. So I know that even if I don't know how New York treats something, I might know it's similar to Oregon, even though they're very far apart from each other. But if you go to Louisiana, because it was originally French, it's based on the Napoleonic Code, and they have different baseline expectations. Are there large groupings of countries that we can understand as similar, or is it every country is different and the difference is meaningful and there's essentially no pattern to it? And so just beware as somebody going into the field and trying to do something in the real world side.
Yes, in Europe, we do have a regulation that classifies non-interventional studies as those studies that have a medicinal product as the focus of the study. For those countries that have adopted that legislation, they're fairly harmonized to some degree, although there are nuances to just be aware of. But then again, it's still going back down to that country level interpretation. There are very important differences, although the idea of a non-interventional study with a medicinal product is still the same across Europe. Going further afield, actually, then it still becomes less harmonized. And other countries do have their own different requirements, particularly if you're taking biosamples that you need to export, or if you're biobanking biosamples on patients, then there's another plethora of legislation to consider.
Do you have a follow-up on that, Stuart?
It's an interesting question, and I think what it comes down to is it took us until, say, 1996 to have some harmonized guidelines, and we pretty much globally harmonized guidelines for clinical trials. And those are the ICH guidelines. And we have ICH GCP, Good Clinical Practice. That has been used as a foundation for the legislation in the majority of countries in the world to guide what you would do for clinical trial. We don't have these real-world studies, such as non-interventional studies and observational studies, but we do have something called the Declaration of Helsinki, which gives us basic principles for how we run these types of studies. So to your original question, you know, what kind of information would you want to give to people who are wanting to run these types of studies? It basically comes down to the fact that there are things like they will need to get protocol that is reviewed and approved by an independent body, so that's your IRBs and your ethics committees. The risk to the patient with these, because it's not a treatment intervention, is generally around data privacy. So if there is a data privacy or protection legislation, then you'll need to ensure that that is complied with. You do that through your informed consent form. It's those kind of basics that you'll see for these types of studies that will be very similar throughout the world, but the legislation is not regulated, as Tara says, and you actually have to seek it out for this type of not clinical trials.
I think most companies have their own, if they're large companies, they have their own regulatory group. If they're smaller companies, they may outsource their regulatory work. Is it the same people that they outsourced it to or their own internal group that they use all the time for their clinical trials? Or is this such a different skill set that it's completely different people?
It's an interesting question because, again, it comes down to clinical trials and it comes down to risk. a lot of what we do within a clinical trial environment, so the informed consent form, a lot of that is about ensuring that we've identified any risks for a novel product to the patient. The patient understands what's going on. And that's where the whole regulatory affairs group will be. They know what they're going to submit for a marketing authorization. They know what documents are going to be patient-facing, and it will identify risk, potential benefits, etc. The skill set then, if you're doing something else, say a non-interventional or an observational study, is that there is very little risk, so you don't want to over-engineer. And it goes back to your Goldilocks effect. You will end up over-engineering it to the point where it's not really an observational study. You don't understand the regulations, and we see it. You submit something as a clinical trial when it's not, and then you don't have all the documentation that you need, like investigational medicinal products. So it's coming back to what is your study in order for you to understand what you need to submit and what level of risk you're acceptable with.
I would add to that as well. There's almost a natural comfort zone with clinical trials. People are very familiar with them, and if they work in them for a long time, it's almost like a default area to go to. And when you're going out of that scope of clinical trial area and regulations, it's actually quite difficult to see how your study can be operationally delivered and still comply with applicable regulations, and that you make the right submissions for your study type in your target country. So I think that's one of those things that is very difficult to overcome, particularly if you don't have the experience or knowledge to help you guide you down the right path of where that submission should go and what documents you need to make the right submission and to the right authorities first time round. I think there's a level of that. It's just having a bit of confidence to know that you're making the right decisions for the study protocol that you want to run in the target country.
I'm glad you mentioned confidence, because I'm ending this conversation feeling very unconfident, very scared about the ability to understand or navigate different countries' regulatory bodies for real-world evidence, or not interventional studies, but observational ones. Can you give me anything that makes me feel better about myself?
Yes, it is confusing, and it's taken us an awfully long time to be confident that we know how to make the right submissions with the protocols that we work with. It's taken experience as well, knowing that every protocol needs to be assessed and classified independently of any other study that we run. That takes practice, and it takes a good understanding of the legislation that we follow. It's also about terminology. You make a good example there, actually. What do we call these studies? There's so many different terms that go around. Are they regulatory terms? Are they way in which the methodology of the project is being run? And that, I think, almost causes more confusion, because people have different understanding of what the definitions of some of these terms are. Yeah, it's taken a lot of learning from outside and practice. We've been doing it a long time, and it's forever developing. We have to be on our toes with the ever-changing regulations and frameworks, particularly with this focus on evidence generation in post-marketing space.
Stuart, last word.
Yeah, I would say from a confidence perspective, what's interesting about these studies is it's all about going back to first principles. It's not about doing what you always did. It's just understanding what you should do. And all you need to do is read the legislation and the guidance documents around it. The mistake people make is assuming first off that they understand what this should be rather than just reading. And that's where Tara's point, confidence, comes, because it takes time and it's a different kind of mindset from what we're used to doing. But it, in essence, is very simple.
Tara Isherwood, Stuart McCulley, thanks so much for joining me on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart, from Syneos Health Consulting. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us on iTunes and Stitcher. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, or if you just want to talk through a particular challenge that you're having at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. We're consultants. That's what we do.